Stalingrad, Kursk, and Tehran restored Stalin's zealous faith in his own infallible greatness. The long, boozy dinners with the magnates started again. Stalin played the ringmaster of a circus of uncouth hijinks, but in the mass of information he received from Beria, there was always much to worry him. The message was clear. Liberalism and ill-discipline threatened the state. The cost of Stalin's victories was vast. Almost 26 million were dead, another 26 million homeless. There was a raging famine, treason among the Caucasian people, a Ukrainian nationalist civil war, and dangerous liberalism among the Russians themselves. All these had to be solved with the traditional Bolshevik solution: terror. On the 20th of May 1944, Stalin met his generals to coordinate the vast summer offensive that would finally toss the Germans off Soviet territory. Much of the Ukraine was already liberated, and the Leningrad siege finally lifted. On the 23rd of June, the offensive shattered the German forces. Minsk and then Lvov were recaptured. On the 8th of July, Zhukov found Stalin at Kuntsevo in great gaiety. He was determined to impose his own government on Poland so that it would never again threaten Russia. Then the Poles threw a spanner into the works. The Red Army offensive had ground to an exhausted halt just east of Warsaw, when, on the 1st of August, General Tadeusz Bokomorowski and the 20,000 patriots of the Polish Home Army rose against the Germans in the Warsaw Rising. But the patriots aimed not to help the Soviet advance, but to forestall it. Hitler ordered that Warsaw be razed, causing 225,000 civilians to be slaughtered in one merciless inferno. The extermination of the Home Army completed the black work of Katyn Forest for Stalin, who had no interest in coming to their rescue. Yet the Rising, and more particularly the Western sympathy for it, sent Stalin into a spin. If its success threatened his Polish plans, then Anglo-American fury about its failure threatened the Grand Alliance. As Churchill and Roosevelt exerted intense pressure on their ally to aid the Poles, Stalin coolly claimed that their account of the Rising was greatly exaggerated. By the time his armies pushed into Poland, it was much too late for the patriots of Warsaw. 7 days after the surrender of the Home Army, Churchill arrived in Moscow to divide up the spoils of Eastern Europe. Stalin had stated his real view in 1942. The question of borders will be decided by force. At Stalin's Kremlin flat, Churchill proposed a naughty document to list their interests in the small countries by percentage. Just as Roosevelt had undermined Churchill at Tehran, so now the Englishman opened this conversation by saying that the Americans would be shocked by the division of Europe into spheres of influence. In Romania, Russia had 90%, Britain 10%. In Greece, Britain had 90%. Russia 10%. Stalin ticked it. The document was taken seriously enough for Eden and Molotov to negotiate for 2 more days about the percentage of Soviet influence in Bulgaria and Hungary, both raised to 80%, and Stalin did stick to his part of the deal on Greece, but that was because it suited him. The percentages agreement was, from Stalin's point of view, surely a bemusing attempt to negotiate what was already a fait accompli. The climax of the visit was Stalin's first public appearance at the Bolshoi since the war began. When the audience saw the two leaders, there were thunderous cheers and clapping. Stalin withdrew modestly, but Churchill sent Vyshinsky to bring him back. The two stood there together, beaming amidst cheering so loud it was like a cloudburst on a tin roof. When Churchill finally left, Stalin personally came to the airport to see him off, waving his handkerchief. Stalin was now enjoying the power of victory, and the bullying showman who emerged was not a pretty sight. His respectful gaiety with Churchill metamorphosed into threatening drunkenness with the less powerful, such as Charles de Gaulle. In December, the Frenchman visited Moscow to sign a treaty of alliance and mutual assistance. In return, Stalin wanted French recognition of the Russian-backed Polish government of Bolesław Bierut, which de Gaulle refused to give. By the time of the official banquet, negotiations were stuck. This did not stop Stalin getting swaggeringly drunk, to the horror of the gloomy de Gaulle. Swigging champagne, Stalin took over the toasts from Molotov. After praising Roosevelt and Churchill while pointedly ignoring de Gaulle, Stalin embarked on a terrifying gallows tour of his entourage. he toasted Kaganovich. A brave man. He knows that if the trains do not arrive on time... He paused. We shall shoot him. Then, Air Force Commander Novikov. Let's drink to him, and if he doesn't do his job properly, we'll hang him. Novikov would soon be arrested and tortured. Noticing the distaste on de Gaulle's face, Stalin chuckled, People call me a monster, but as you see, I make a joke of it. Maybe I'm not horrible after all. While the diplomats negotiated, Stalin drank more champagne. Finally, in the early hours when de Gaulle had gone to bed, the Russians suddenly agreed to sign the treaty without recognition of Belarus government. De Gaulle was rushed back into the Kremlin, where Stalin first asked him to sign the original treaty. When de Gaulle angrily retorted, France has been insulted, Stalin cheerfully called for the new draft, which was then signed. As the fastidious Frenchman left, Stalin called for his interpreter and laughed. You know too much. I'd better send you to Siberia. De Gaulle looked back one last time. I saw Stalin sitting alone at a table. He had started eating again. When Stalin eyed the great prize of Berlin, he decided to change the way he ran the war. Henceforth, the Supremo would command directly. Zhukov was to command the first Belarusian front that was to fight the 500 miles to Berlin. 6 million Soviet soldiers were massed for the Vistula-Oder offensive. 2 weeks later, Konev was plunged into industrial Silesia. Zhukov had expelled the Germans from central Poland, and Malinovsky was fighting frenziedly for Budapest. The second and third Belarusian fronts broke into East Prussia, Germany itself, in a fiesta of vengeance. 2 million German women were to be raped in the coming months. Russian soldiers even raped Russian women, newly liberated from Nazi camps. When Gilas, a Yugoslav Politburo member, protested, Stalin responded, You have, of course, read Dostoevsky. Do you see what a complicated thing is man's soul? Well then, imagine a man who has fought over thousands of kilometers of his own devastated land, across the dead bodies of his comrades and dearest ones. How can such a man react normally, and what is so awful about his having fun with a woman after such horrors? By the 29th of January, Zhukov was on the Oder. As German forces counterattacked the Soviet bridgeheads, Roosevelt and Churchill were being greeted at Saki Air Force Base in the Crimea by Molotov, on their way to the Yalta Conference. 5 districts around the Black Sea Resort had been purged of suspicious elements. 74,000 people had been checked, and 835 arrested. With its towns deserted and ruined after the depredations of the Nazis and the deportation of the Tatars, it was no wonder Churchill dubbed it Yalta, the Riviera of Hades. On the 6th of February, the Big Three met to discuss the painful subject of Poland and the world organization that would become the UN. Russia would take eastern slices of Poland in exchange for grants of German territory in the west. Stalin agreed to include a few Polish nationalists in his communist-dominated government. When FDR said the Polish elections had to be beyond question like Caesar's wife, Stalin quipped, They said that about her, but she had her sins. He explained the Russian obsession with Poland. Throughout history, it has served as a corridor for enemies coming to attack Russia. The leaders approved the 3 zones of occupation in a demilitarized and denazified Germany. On the 8th, after another meeting, they dined with Stalin at the Yusupov Palace, where their opening speeches became more and more emotional as the Big Three, all aged by war, contemplated their victory. Stalin toasted Churchill, a man who was born once in 100 years and who bravely held up the banner of Great Britain. Stalin was... In the very best of form, wrote Brooke, and was full of fun and good humour. Stalin, who fooled no one when he described himself as a naive, garrulous old man, ominously toasted the generals, who are recognised only during a war and whose services after the war are quickly forgotten. After the war, their prestige goes down and the ladies turn their back on them. The generals did not yet realise he meant to forget them himself. This epic dinner boasted one unusual guest. Stalin invited a delighted Beria, who was beginning to find his normally secret role constricting. Roosevelt asked Stalin, "Who's that in the pince-nez?"
"Ah, that one. That's our Himmler," replied Stalin with deliberate malice. "That's Beria."
The secret policeman said nothing, just smiled, showing his yellow teeth. "But it must have cut him to the quick," wrote his son, who knew how he longed to step onto the world stage. The sex-obsessed Beria was soon discussing the sex life of fishes with Sir Archibald Clark Kerr. When he was thoroughly drunk, Sir Archibald stood up and toasted Beria, "the man who looks after our bodies." Churchill considered Beria the wrong sort of friend for the ambassador. "No, Archie, none of that. Be careful." He waved his finger. On the 10th of February, at Churchill's dinner, they discussed the upcoming British elections, which Stalin was sure Churchill would win. "Who could be a better leader than he who won the victory?" Churchill explained that there were two parties. "One party is much better," Stalin said. Stalin had won virtually all he wanted from the Allies, and this is usually blamed on Roosevelt's illness and susceptibility to Stalinist charm. Both Westerners stand accused of selling out Eastern Europe to Stalin. Roosevelt's courtship of Stalin and discourtesy to Churchill were misguided. FDR was certainly ill and exhausted, but Stalin himself always believed that force would decide who ruled Eastern Europe, which was occupied by 10 million Soviet soldiers. On the 8th of March, amidst operations to clean up Pomerania, Stalin summoned Zhukov to Kuntsevo for a meeting. The Supremo was ill and greatly overexhausted. He seemed depressed. "He had worked too much and slept too little," thought Zhukov. The battle for Berlin was to be his last great effort. Afterwards he could no longer sustain that tempo of work. He was not alone. Roosevelt was dying. Hitler almost senile. Churchill often ill. Total war took a total toll on its warlords.
"Let's stretch our legs a little. I feel sort of limp," said Stalin. As they walked, Stalin talked about his childhood for an hour. Encouraged by this surprising intimacy, Zhukov asked about Yakov. After about 100 steps in silence, Stalin answered in a subdued voice, "Yakov won't be able to get out of captivity. They'll shoot him, the killers."
"From what we know, they're keeping him separately and persuading him to betray his country."
Stalin was silent again. Then he said,
"No, Yakov would prefer any kind of death to betraying the motherland."
He was proud of his son at last, but did not know that Yakov had been dead for almost 2 years. 3 weeks later, on the morning of the 1st of April, Stalin held a conference with Zhukov and Konev, his two most aggressive marshals.
"Well, who's going to take Berlin? We or the Allies?" "It's we who'll take Berlin," barked Konev, before Zhukov could even answer.
"So that's the sort of man you are," Stalin grinned approvingly.
Zhukov was to assault Berlin from the Oder bridgeheads over the Seelof Heights, Konev to push towards Leipzig and Dresden, with his northern flank thrusting towards southern Berlin, parallel to Zhukov. The supremo of ambiguity allowed them both to believe that they could take Berlin. Without saying a word, Stalin drew the demarcation line between the fronts into Berlin, then stopped and erased the line to the south of Berlin. Konev understood this allowed him to join in the storming of Berlin, if he could. That very day, in what one historian has described as the greatest April fool in modern history, Stalin reassured Eisenhower that Berlin has lost its former strategic importance. 2 days later, the two marshals actually raced to the airport, their planes taking off within 2 minutes of each other. Such, Konev admitted, was their passionate desire to take the prize. On the 20th of April, Zhukov reached Berlin's eastern suburbs. Both marshals fought, house by house, street by street, towards Hitler's chancellery. On the 25th, Konev ordered an assault towards the Reichstag. 300 yards from the Reichstag building, Chuikov, who was leading Zhukov's thrust, encountered Konev's tanks. Zhukov himself sped up and shouted at Konev's tank commander, "Why have you appeared here?" Konev, disappointed, left the Reichstag to Zhukov, but Stalin offered another prize. "Who's going to take Prague?" In the early hours of May Day, Zhukov telephoned Kuntsevo. Once again, security refused to help. "Comrade Stalin's just gone to bed," replied General Vlasik. "Please wake him," retorted Zhukov. "The matter's urgent and cannot wait until morning." Stalin picked up the phone and heard that Hitler was dead. So that's the end of the bastard. Stalin was furious when a junior general signed the German surrender at Reims and ordered Zhukov to get a proper surrender in Berlin. But the glory days of the generals were over. Vyshinsky arrived to handle political matters and spent the entire ceremony bobbing up to whisper instructions in Zhukov's ear. Stalin closely watched Zhukov and his supposed delusions of grandeur. Later in the year, he summoned him to the Kremlin to warn him that Beria and Avakumov were gathering evidence against him. "I don't believe all this nonsense, but stay out of Moscow." That was not a problem, since Zhukov was Stalin's proconsul in Berlin. Stalin dispatched his satraps to rule his new empire. Mikoyan flew in to feed the Germans. Malenkov and Vosniesensky arrived to fight about whether to loot German industry or to preserve it to build a Soviet satellite regime. Zhdanov held court in Finland, Voroshilov in Hungary, Bulganin in Poland, Vyshinsky in Romania. On the 24th of May, Stalin hosted a banquet for the Politburo and marshals, singers, actors, and even Polish miners in the Georgievsky Hall. There was a traffic jam of limousines all the way to the Borovitsky Gate. When Stalin appeared, ovations and shouts of hurrah shook the vaulted halls with a deafening roar. Molotov toasted the marshals, who clinked glasses with the Politburo. When Admiral Isakov, who had lost his leg in 1942, was toasted, Stalin, still a master of the personal touch, walked all the way over to his distant table to clink glasses. Then Stalin praised the Russian people. "Another people could have said to the government, 'You have not justified our expectations. Go away, and we will install another government, which will conclude peace with Germany and guarantee us a quiet life.'" Later, Stalin asked Zhukov and the marshals, "Don't you think we should celebrate with a victory parade?" Stalin decided to take the review on horseback. He could not ride, but his hunger for glory still burned, and he started secretly training to ride a white Arab stallion, chosen by Budyonny. About a week before the parade, the horse threw Stalin, bruising his shoulder. Pulling himself to his feet, he spat, "Let Zhukov take the parade. He's a cavalryman." At 9:57 a.m. on the 24th of June, Zhukov mounted the stallion at the Spassky Gate. It was pouring with rain. The clocks struck 10. "Parade, shun!" "My heart beat faster," wrote Zhukov. Simultaneously, Marshal Rokossovsky was waiting on Budyonny's own black charger at the Nikolsky Gate. Stalin, in his greatcoat, showing no expression, walked clumsily, slowly, out on his own, then lightly bounded up the steps to the mausoleum, with Beria and Malenkov sweating breathlessly in their efforts to keep up. When the crowd saw him, hurrahs resounded across the square. The rain poured, the water running down his visor. He never wiped his face. As the chimes rang out, Zhukov and Rokossovsky rode out, both soaked, and the bands played Glinka's "Slavsia," "Glory to You," and tanks and Katyushas rumbled over the cobblestones. Silence fell on Red Square. Then a menacing staccato beat of hundreds of drums could be heard. 200 veterans approached, each holding a Nazi banner emblazoned with the swastika. At the mausoleum, they did a right turn and flung the banners at Stalin's feet, where the downpour soaked them. Here was the climax of Stalin's life. As soon as it was over, Stalin and the top brass poured into the room behind the mausoleum for a buffet and drinks. It was here that one of the marshals first proposed promoting Stalin to generalissimo. He waved this away, declaring that he was now 67 and weary. "I'll work another 2 or 3 years, then I'll have to retire." The Politburo and the marshals cried out on cue that he would live to rule the country for a long time yet. During the hard-drinking festivities, Stalin laughed as Paskryovichev slipped the ceremonial dagger out of Vyshinsky's diplomatic uniform and replaced it with a pickle. The pompous ex-procurator strutted around for the rest of the day, oblivious of the vegetable in his scabbard and the smirks of the magnates. That night, at a banquet for 2,500 officers, Stalin, who was already thinking about how to tighten discipline and bind the Union together, toasted the Russian people, the ordinary people, without whom all of us, marshals and commanders of fronts and armies, would not be worth a damn. In these carefully phrased toasts, Stalin set down a marker for his courtiers. The marshals were not worth a damn compared to the Russian people, whom only the party, Stalin, could represent. His talk of retirement unleashed a brutal struggle among ruthless men to succeed a 20th-century emperor who had no intention of ever retiring. Within 5 years, 3 of the contenders would be dead.